From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with sleight-of-hand artist Ricky Jay. His book, Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, catalogs some of the most amazing and eccentric acts in the history of the circus and variety entertainment. Also today, I speak with Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly, the creators of Raw, a magazine of avant-garde comics and graphics. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recent recording of Klaus Tennstedt conducting the London Philharmonic in Mahler's Eighth Symphony. And our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg analyzes words that we've recently elevated to the status of superlative. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. A sleight-of-hand artist and a scholar of the unusual. That's how my guest Ricky Jay describes himself. His book, Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, is an encyclopedia of attractions without parallel. Sword swallowers, daredevils, freaks, and other sensational acts like Mac Norton, the human aquarium, who swallowed live goldfish and frogs in his performances. Ricky Jay has perfected a few astounding acts of his own. He's in the Guinness Book of Records for throwing playing cards 190 feet at 90 miles per hour. He's the curator of the Mulholland Library of Conjuring and the Allied Arts in Los Angeles. And he's worked with Joseph Papp and Francis Coppola, coaching actors in magic. And he appears in David Mamet's new film, House of Games, for which he also acted as a consultant on con games. Ricky Jay, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
Before we talk about your work as a magician and your knowledge of con artists, let's talk about some of the people in your new book. I want to ask you about John Cummings, who really, really interested me for some reason. He was a knife swallower who literally swallowed knives whole.
Yeah, I guess the most interesting thing about John Cummings is he was a sailor, an American sailor on some boats in Europe, and he no doubt witnessed the performance of a French magician who pretended to swallow knives in some drunken, boisterous aftermath. He decided that he could do anything this magician did and really swallowed these knives. He had a dinner of five or six knives, and then after his initial success, ran around having people gather all the cutlery in the ship until he had eventually swallowed every knife on the ship. And so he was a totally impromptu and an unprofessional sword swallower. But later, apparently, after consuming every potable in sight, he would repeat these odd bouts. And two or three other times in his career, he actually swallowed many, many knives.
And apparently, when they did the autopsy on him, they found about 14 knives embedded in his stomach.
Yeah, that's he actually once swallowed so many knives that he began this fairly visible emaciation in the weeks that followed his last knife-eating bout. And the autopsy did reveal these knives all in his stomach. He just swallowed case knives whole, you know, folding knives in cases and tableware cutlery, and eventually died from the lodging of one of the knives in his body.
Why are you interested in all these really eccentric acts?
Well, I should point out that you're the one who mentioned it. Although I did write about John Cummings, it was merely a footnote to other more professional acts. John Cummings is not the focal point of this book. I do have a section on swallowing acts, people who ate this odd assortment of things. I mean, sword swallowers being the most famous. I suppose I have a true fascination with unusual entertainment. As you mentioned, I've been known to do some fairly unusual things myself, and over the years I've compiled data and playbills and books on all of these odd performers.
I'm going to ask you about somebody else who's in your book, and this is Johnny Eck, who some of our listeners might also know as one of the actors in Freaks.
Okay, before you explain, let me tell the story before you explain who he was in Freaks for those who don't know his name, because I find this literally the single most bizarre tale in the annals of conjuring. What happened was that in the 1930s and 40s, a magician named Raja Raboid used to work a fairly large illusion show. Actually, I'll tell you an odd anecdote about Raja Raboid, which is not in the book, but since you mentioned I throw cards, Raja Raboid was a great card thrower in terms of this old game of throwing cards into a top hat. And he used to hustle in the millineries on Broad Street in the 30s. And there were all these hat boys used to sit in the backs of these shops and throw cards into hats and got very good at it. But Raja Roboid was actually quite remarkable at this stunt. And he would go in and find these hat boys who thought they were great and get them to bet him, you know, a dollar per card for whoever throws the most cards in, or side bets of hundreds of dollars, whatever he could muster up. And if the hat boy would throw 42 out of 52 cards in the hat, that would be really wonderful. And Roboid would miss just as often as he had to have 40 cards in the hat and three cards left in his hand, and just happened to get all the last three in, so he would throw in 43. If the person threw in 28, he'd throw in 29. And he supplemented his income by hustling throwing cards in the hat. Anyway, he had this show, which was not a top-level show by any stretch of the imagination, but one year he decided he would do this variation of the standard sawing of a magician's assistant in half. And he thought it would be much more interesting if he borrowed a volunteer from the audience, because everybody assumes the magician's assistant is in cahoots, or that there are two of them and there are actually two people in this cabinet instead of one. And so he went into his shows and he asked someone in the audience to stand up. And instead of a woman, a man stood up in the audience. And this man, in full view of the audience, walked onto stage. And Raja Roboid placed him in this box, and his assistants brought out a saw, and they sawed the box in half and pushed the two halves aside, and everybody applauded, and then they pushed the two halves back together, and the man got up and started walking back to the audience. And as he took a few steps downstage, suddenly his body toppled over in half. Literally, the trunk started walking off the stage to the left, and the pair of pants, the waist and legs of the man, started walking off the stage to the right. And people in the audience were gasping and fainting and screaming as they actually watched the trunk move into the left part of the aisle, and the pants move into the right part of the aisle. And the way he was able to accomplish this, even though I don't make a habit of exposing all these illusions, this is truly bizarre enough to talk about for your listeners. He had Johnny Eck, who was in Freaks and was only half a man. He stopped at the waist, actually a little lower than the waist, but the photographs always made it look like he was cut off right at the waist. And he, of course, was the half of the man that walked into the audience, you know, crawled into the audience using just his arms. And the other half was a midget with a pair of pants pulled up over his head. But the thing that made this such a remarkable story was that the original volunteer from the audience was Johnny Eck's twin brother, full-sized, completely normal twin brother. So I think that's what gave this remarkable verisimilitude and made people truly scream, is that they saw this man walk up, they switched him for the midget and Johnny Eck, and people just went wild.
Pretty remarkable. This is one of the acts that is mentioned in Ricky Jay's book. What's the title again? It's Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, full of totally bizarre and astounding acts. Now, have you been to a lot of places where you can see acts like this in modern times? Have you been to freak shows, traveled with circuses, anything like that?
Well, I actually did briefly run a Carney 5-in-1 show.
You ran a freak show?
Yes, I actually did perform it. It seems like a strange job to have
winding
up
not
in a museum as a curator of rare books. But yeah, I did indeed. Yeah, it was a show that traveled along the East Coast. This was about 15 years ago, and it was a show that was in operation then. And we exhibited a number of attractions. The difference between a 5-in-1 and a 10-in-1 show are basically the number of attractions, 5-in-1 being smaller. Five different shows under one roof. I should do the pitch for you.
Would you?
Showtime, circus time, see the magician, the fireman appellator, the girl with yellow elastic tissue, the electrode lady. Yes, the electrode lady. She and her sister were struck by lightning. Her sister died, but she lived to tell the tale. 20,000 volts of electricity through the young girl's body. The doctor said she lived because she was immune to the shock of electricity. See the monster child from Johannesburg, South Africa, the monster child with one head, two bodies, three arms, and four legs. You read about it in your leading periodicals. You read about it in the National Enquirer. Then see Adam and Eve, boy and girl, brother and sister, all in one of the world's three living morphidites, which will expose itself not to be rude or vulgar, but to show you Mother Nature's curious mistakes. Showtime, circus time, let's go be going.
And did you write that yourself?
Oh, no, it's actually fascinating that almost anyone who has worked as a Carney talker will do a variation of that speech. It's been handed down verbally, and the pronunciations like morphodite for hermaphrodite and curious for curious are pretty much the same way you'll hear them in most parts of the country. I mean, the problem being that these days you don't hear much of this at all. There are not too many shows like this in existence anymore.
Were the freaks in this freak show freaks or cons?
A combination. For instance, the monster child from Johannesburg, Sat Attica, was in fact what they call a pickled punk, or literally a fetus in formaldehyde, showing two heads, three bodies, four arms, three bodies and four legs. And that was, a con. The hermaphrodite was also a con, which we'll dispense with for the moment. It was not a person with the sexes of both in one body, but a made-up piece. But the fire eater and the sword swallower and the electrode lady were all, doing what they claimed to be doing. I can't say that this woman really was able to resist the shock of the electricity, but one could present her in a fashion that did.
What kind of getup did you wear to do the barking?
Nothing particularly elaborate. I mean, basically just street clothes, although the show was run by a rather sad old-timer with gold lame hair and lots of tattoos. And it was an odd group. I mean, the carny world is a very strange world, and these were strange folks.
The impression I have is that there aren't as many freak shows as there used to be, in part because we've all, I think, become much too self-conscious to go and gawk at the freaks. And I think also so that there are so many chemical deformities now that freaks have a different meaning, if you know what I mean?
I don't know. It's an interesting thought. I would think it has more to do with the fact that there are not as many natural freaks now as there used to be.
Gee, I thought in a way it would be the other way around.
No, I don't think so.
During pregnancy and things like
well,
that.
Well, there are some similarities. I mean, it's odd that we're off on this strange tack. I mean, I feel a certain need to tell your listeners that the book is not totally about freaks.
Right.
It's about remarkable performers. But this is a lead-in to a man who may be my favorite performer in the book. His name was Matthew Buchinger, and he was born in Nuremberg in 1674, and he was only 28 inches tall, and he had flippers very much like the deformities we saw when these horrible thalidomide cases came out a few years ago, just these little flippers. But this man was able to master the playing of more than a dozen musical instruments. He did absolutely remarkable calligraphy. He would throw swords and hit a mark. He would fire pistols, and he was a great conjurer. He was a great magician, and so well known that at one point he was actually considered the greatest German living. And there are elegies at his death, in collections by Swift and other leading poets and playwrights of the day. I mean, he was remarkably accomplished, and extraordinary. But nevertheless, there seem to be many less people like that. A good example is Siamese twins, who now can almost always be split, although usually using very delicate operations. And so there are many less Siamese twins, for instance.
You know what I have to tell you? The person who you just mentioned, Buchinger, who had no limbs but was able to still paint with his mouth, I guess.
No, actually not. In his case, he pushed the flippers together. I do talk about some
But there's
the
a woman
Sarah Biffin, who painted with a brush in her mouth. Yeah.
Now, to show how I think things have changed on Our Magazine, which is a morning talk show TV magazine, they did a feature on a woman who had no arms and she painted with her toes. But this was, they pitched it as a self-help kind of thing, self-improvement. It's like, she could paint with your toes, you can do anything too. it was absolutely different from the freak show approach. I mean,
well, it's fascinating about both Miss Biffin and Buchinger that many of the people who were exhibited in this way in this book were very special in the sense that they weren't brought out and put with traveling showman's caravans. And were allowed to develop as people first. That was far more uncommon then than it is now. Far more uncommon, where they were easily exploited.
You once said, I think, that you would have liked to live in Elizabethan times. What would you have been able to see then or do then that you couldn't now?
Well, I think this demimonde, this odd world that I find so comfortable, was slightly more prevalent. You know, I've always had this fascination with street performers and entertainers and gamblers and con men. And in Elizabethan times, they were very much linked, strangely enough, with the writers of the day, the pamphleteers and writers. You know, that was considered a pretty strange profession to be able to sit down and write and try to earn a living. And so the interests that I have seem to, in some extent, coincide with that. I'm also a fan of canting terms, slang terms used by the criminal element in Elizabethan times and then on upwards. So,
my guest is Ricky Jay, and he describes himself as a scholar of the eccentric, and he's written a book called Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women. He's also a sleight-of-hand artist, and we'll talk more about his own work as a magician. But first, we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ricky Jay is my guest. Let's talk about how you first got interested in magic. Now, I think it was your grandfather who was
my grandfather
a magician?
Was a well-known amateur magician in New York. He didn't do magic professionally, but in a way that was a great lesson because he was an amateur in the true sense of the word, a real lover of the art, and was a great influence on me. And he invented a lot of original magic and had things published during his lifetime. So I grew up not only with him, but with a chance to see other wonderful performers who very much influenced me as a kid.
I always think if you put a magician and a kid together, then the magician is going to pull quarters from the kid's nose, things like that, the standard magician tricks.
Yeah, that's the toughest image to overcome is that kind of. I've said somewhere that magic seems to me the only art form that's been shaped by amateurs instead of professionals. Because of that concept that most people have, they can't seem to tell the difference between their Uncle Harry who takes a quarter out of your ear and somebody who's worked 10 hours a day for their entire life to do, some really beautiful effect with a coin.
So the quarters out of the ear isn't the kind of magic that you were exposed to
I was exposed to literally the best people in the world, many of whom are still alive. Sly Deeney, who's in his late 80s or 90 in New York. Di Vernon, who's 93 in California.
Would they show you the tricks, show you how they work?
Well, it's very interesting. There's an unexpressed apprenticeship that one goes through. I mean, clearly I had access because of my grandfather at an early age, but I didn't talk very much. I watched and tried to pick up what I could. But as I got older, for instance, I moved to California some 12 or 13 years ago to be with Vernon, who, as I mentioned, is still there in 93 and most people think is the preeminent figure in sleight of hand. And he would never accept money for lessons and he would always tell you he wasn't teaching you. But clearly he was. He was challenging you at every opportunity and making you think for yourself and inventing effects and even going beyond that. I mean, to the point of if you had invented something and you really were proud of it, he would kind of give you a smile, to lead you to believe it wasn't very good and then go and tell somebody else who was young and really an upcoming young performer that you had just invented this wonderful effect. And then he would come back and tell you that the other guy had just invented a wonderful effect. I mean, he really played the role of almost a Zen master. And try to get people to think really well for themselves.
Yeah. One of your specialties is card throwing.
Yeah.
What do you do with a talent like that?
There's not a great demand for it. I think one establishes whatever demand there is. Early on, wound up throwing cards at great distances. You know, as a kid in Brooklyn and then later in New Jersey, I mean, I threw baseball cards. And you used to have games, throwing cards for distance or closest to the wall or knocking down leaners. And I think maybe because I practiced with cards even at that young age a lot, I had some facility with it. And, it turns out that I throw these things farther and faster than anybody does. Actually, in the 20s and 30s, there really was a trend of stage magicians. Well, it goes back to the 1850s of magicians throwing souvenir cards to their audiences in large theaters and throwing cards into the balconies of theaters. Generally, they were heavier cards than actual playing cards. And my first book called Cards as Weapons was a study of self-defense with ordinary playing cards, giving techniques about how to throw them. And that's going to be reprinted by Warner's this coming year.
So. A kind of tongue-in-cheek.
I would have to confess, if pressed, that there were tongues and cheeks to be found in that book, yeah.
Well, you do a very ironic kind of magic in a way, because you're, I think, commenting on the sleight of hand as you do the sleight of hand in your
act? I suppose to some extent, yeah. I mean, certainly irony runs through the performance. I try to make it nonlinear. I don't want things to start out where you can anticipate their endings by the time I've given you the first sentence. So.
Now, you're also interested in con games. Do you consider magic a conning act?
Well, you know, I at times feel that I have to draw the line. I mean, here we are talking about freaks and cons and all sorts of fields with some sort of pejorative connotation. And yet I believe that many of the people I write about in this book were great artists, and that somehow one doesn't preclude the other. That there can be people who were absolutely wonderful artists, whether they're in this sort of netherworld area or not. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's very exciting.
When you're, what kind of venues have you come up with to perform your magic act in? Where did you start establishing yourself?
Well, I've really run the gamut. I mean, I worked early years where I would just do close-up magic. I rebelled against being on a stage, and I would, where I think when I did The Tonight Show the first time 20 years ago with hair down on my waist wearing a T-shirt and a pair of jeans, I mean, that was a very strange way to be presenting it, but I hated that classic image of a magician then and refused to work on stage. Then I went through a period where I may have been the first magician to ever work consistently with rock and roll bands. I used to go on tour for almost 10 years of my life, opening shows for a wide variety of music acts, Cheech and Chong and Emmylou Harris and Herbie Hancock, and I mean just the B-52s. I mean, and you know, over a long period I did that. I worked carny freak shows. I worked on the street. I worked in theaters. I worked every opportunity I could, and the venues were as different as they could possibly be, because that was a learning experience. But particularly the most difficult thing of all of those was working close-up. Now the concept of close-up magic has gained a great deal in popularity, and most major cities somewhere in a good restaurant or hotel will have a magician who comes to your table and does magic. But when I first started, I don't think there were more than a half a dozen people in the country who made a full-time living doing that. And so the difficulty was convincing someone to hire you. It wasn't the difficulty of making them enjoy what you performed, but rather why would they want to put you in their room to begin with?
Is close-up magic more difficult because the person's eyes are that?
Well,
that
technically
close to
you? It probably is. It's also why it gives me so much pleasure. Yeah, it's usually done with sleight of hand rather than with some tricked boxes or odd apparatus. You know, and as you say, if you're doing it surrounded with people, you know, right on your coat sleeves, you have to be good, and you know, that just made it more fun. And I think it makes the audience. It's to this day the most rewarding performances. You know, the most rewarding genre for me to be in.
You will be seen in the forthcoming movie House of Cards.
House of Games.
House of Games, I'm sorry, by David Mamet. And you're not only in it, but you consulted on con games.
Right, yeah, it's a movie about a mob of con men, and I'm an actor in it. I don't do any magic, but I do play a gambler.
What kind of con games did you come up with for the movie?
Well, it's hard to explain them without tipping the movie. I mean, one of the nice things about seeing a movie with cons
is that we're
con
at the same time.
Is that you are con. So I think I'll be cryptic about that, but it was fun. And the movie opened last week in both New York and Los Angeles, so I think it'll be soon in your cities. Yeah, it's in this particular case, it's a very interesting story about a woman psychiatrist being so intrigued with a con man that she meets in the course of her work that she wants to find out more about it, and there's just a constant series of surprises. So.
Are there interesting swindles going on city streets today?
Yeah, sure. I mean, things. You know, one of the observations that I try to make in the book, and I don't spend a lot of time doing that. I mean, mostly I'm just presenting facts about people. But it does seem to me, and I mentioned in the introduction, that I believe people are swindled the same way now that they were in the Elizabethan times, 400 years ago. They're fooled by the same things, and they're delighted by the same things. Very little has changed. There are swindling and cheating techniques done with cards and dice that are absolutely explained in detail in books from the 1550s that are still being done now.
Things like three card Monte.
Three card Monte doesn't go back that far. That's a fairly recent origin. But the three shell game, which is a version of thimble rigging, goes back to I've been trying to trace it back to the 17th century, and I haven't been able to, but I've certainly been able to trace it back to the very early 18th century. By 1714, there are clearly references to swindlers using a pea under a thimble. And that game has changed very, very little in the ensuing years.
Have you ever gone up to swindlers or con men and tried to beat them at their own game?
It's a very dangerous thing to do. It's a very bad thing to do. I think there's some people in this field who think that if they're magicians and know something about this, this is a great opportunity for them. One has to make the distinction that these people are, for the most part, criminals. And even though I have, like I say, this respect for what they do and some great feeling, you can be in a very bad situation if you see somebody playing three-card Monte on the street and want to go up and say, I know something about cards too. I know how to do this move and make the queen go into the middle when it doesn't look like it's there. So no, I don't do that. But I have some friends and have had friends for many years who are on that side of the fence and still maintain my connections with them. But I don't walk up to people in the midst of a game and point out the queen, even though I can do that. It's not healthy.
For a while, you lived the carny life. You worked on this carnival show and Hawk the Freak show. Would you have wanted to stay in a life like that?
I don't know. I think the thing that's really intrigued me in my life and interested me in my life is that I've had the opportunity to do so many different things. I wouldn't want to spend 50 weeks a year in Las Vegas, but it's nice to spend one in Las Vegas. I've worked on cruise ships. Maybe every 5 years I decide it's nice to take a cruise and do that. But I've never found any one thing that would have kept me doing it for the rest of my life.
Did your parents ever, do you think, say to themselves, why did we bother assimilating and trying to be successful in business or whatever so that our son can run off and be a magician and join
I suppose if I were talking to them, they would have said something very much like that. But because that was clearly their attitude a long time ago, I haven't said a word to them for a good 20 years or so, so I wouldn't know.
Where have you been researching the bizarre performers?
All over the world, really. I mean, I would go as a performer to different cities and different countries to perform and usually spend my days in the libraries researching. So I did a great deal of research at the British Museum and the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris and museums in Tokyo and in South America and even in Johannesburg. I mean, the strangest places. It's taken me almost 10 years to compile all of this information. But that was always a great pleasure. And I also scour rare bookshops and print shops, and I've collected this material for a long time as well.
Have you ever tried to do any of the more unusual acts?
Yeah, absolutely. In my shows, I do lecture demonstrations fairly often about such things, and I do. And I try to make them a little different. Sometimes I'll do shows with specific historical accuracy, but usually I switch things. And for instance, Harry Kahn, who I mentioned in the book, the multiple mental marvel, who would hang upside down at a blackboard doing magic squares at the same time reciting poetry from any number of sources that you mentioned and shouting out the population of any city that you could name and writing with both hands and both feet, inspired a performance piece that I do. Where I do a chess problem called the Chess Knight's Tour. I have a big blackboard in the room, and I let a spectator pick any starting square. The board is numbered from 1 to 64. And from that point, without my ever looking at the board, I want to try to call out a series of moves that are all legitimate moves that a knight would make on the board. And at the same time I'm doing that, I do a reading from any Shakespeare play suggested by the audience and also do cue brutes mentally at the same time. So.
I'd like to see that sometime. I want to thank you very much for talking with us about magic and freaks and cons and eccentric performers. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Ricky Jay, who's a sleight-of-hand artist and has also written a history of unique, eccentric, and amazing entertainers. The book is called Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, and it's just been published in paper by Warner Books. He can also be seen in David Mamet's new film, House of Games. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Soviet-born comedian Yakov Smirnov. He left a career as a stand-up comic in the Soviet Union and came to the United States with only $100 in his pocket. That was 10 years ago, and he's since become one of the most successful comics in America. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly talk about Raw, the magazine they created as an outlet for the avant-garde and unusual in comic and graphic art. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording of Mahler's Eighth Symphony, performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra under the baton of Klaus Tennstedt. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines some of the latest expressions we've come up with to say something's the best. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Dale Willman in Washington. The stock market sustained the rally begun yesterday with another record advance. According to preliminary figures, the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped more than 187 points to close at 2028.02. Today's increase seemed healthier than yesterday's because it was not confined to the Dow's blue-chip stocks. Late in the day, advances led declines by 10 to 1, and trading today was not marked by the wild swings in buying and selling that marked yesterday's activity. In New York, market analyst Alan Ackerman had some advice for small investors.
Not to panic, to be value-orientated, not to be looking for a quick kill, but on the other side, not to throw stocks out the window, because if they have relatively decent equities, once things calm down, I think some of these stocks will find their way back. And long-term, stocks have done well, so I think people ought to calm down, look for a good broker. But more than anything else, look for a sense of inner confidence and not put all their money to work at once, nor to get rid of everything they have.
Yesterday's rally on Wall Street helped improve prices on foreign exchanges today. The London Stock Exchange closed more than 140 points higher, and prices took a record one-day jump on the Tokyo Exchange. The Nobel Prize for Economics will go to an MIT professor for his work in explaining the factors that contribute to economic growth. Robert Solow won the prize for a paper he wrote in 1956 that shows how savings, capital, technology, and labor affect a nation's economic future. At a news conference today, Solow was asked a number of questions about current economic trends. He said the government will have to take some painful steps to correct imbalances in the economy.
The things that we have to do to make the balance of payments better, to make the savings investment balance better, the federal budget deficit better, are things which are required fundamentally for the health of the economy, but they are not going to make life good for us in the next couple of years.
Solow's theories are used by economic planners around the world to project economic growth. 3 days of fog have shut down flights in and out of Moscow, so Secretary of State George Shultz is traveling there by train for 2 days of meetings with top Soviet officials. A Soviet spokesman today said that Kremlin leader Mikhail Gorbachev will try to move toward a treaty cutting strategic arms when he meets with Shultz on Friday. In Helsinki today, Shultz told reporters he is sure progress will be made in arms control. However, he said he hopes the medium-range INF missile issue won't get in the way of other talks.
We had hoped that we'd get the INF question settled insofar as possible, because when it isn't and when we have to spend our time on it, then that just sort of eats into the time that you can spend on other things. So we hope that we can work that through, and of course we have developed a pattern of working.
While in Moscow, Shultz also hopes to set a precise date for a summit meeting between Soviet leader Gorbachev and President Reagan. The Senate began debate today on Robert Bork's nomination to the Supreme Court. Democrats and Republicans continue to disagree on how long the debate should last. Democrats want it to run through Friday, but Senate Majority Leader Robert Byrd says there's no reason debate should last the rest of this week because the nomination faces almost certain defeats. President Reagan will hold his third news conference of the year tomorrow night. The president held his last news conference in Venice in June. His last session at the White House was in March. A powerful explosion rocked oil installations near the Kuwait-Saudi Arabian border today. Gulf-based oil executives are saying the explosion could be the work of an Iranian silkworm missile or an operation by the work of by Iranian saboteurs. You're listening to National Public Radio News. I'm Dale Willman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a tribute to conductor Klaus Tennstedt, who due to illness recently stepped down from his post as principal conductor and music director of the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Tennstedt was born 51 years ago in Germany, and during his career has conducted major orchestras in East and West Germany, Sweden, and the United States. Lloyd says Tennstedt has always been able to draw vibrant, intense performances from his players.
Klaus Tennstedt, the East German conductor who established himself in the West as one of the last major musicians in a disappearing European tradition, is very ill. He has resigned his directorship of the London Philharmonic, the orchestra with whom he recorded his complete Mahler cycle, and he's had to cancel his American tour. If he has, in effect, truly retired, he'll be deeply missed not only by his extremely devoted following, affectionately called the Klausketeers, but by anyone who loves the mainstream of Austro-German symphonic music, especially Mahler. It seems that great performances of the so-called standard repertory are getting rarer and rarer. But you could count on Tennstedt, especially his live performances, which had a kind of manic power. His gangly figure, his arms hovering and flapping like a giant flamingo, were an extraordinary, almost comical sight. But he could galvanize the most jaded of orchestras. His recordings somehow don't always capture the concert hall experience. They're too much of the studio. Often the playing is limp or even sloppy. But the last of his Mahler recordings may be his best. It's the impossible Eighth Symphony, the Symphony of a Thousand, Mahler's most rhetorically inflated and least melodically inspired major symphonic work. Few good performances, let alone good recordings, are known to exist. In joining an elaborate choral setting of the Catholic hymn Veni Creator Spiritus, the first part of the symphony, with the final transfiguration scene of part two of Goethe's Faust, the symphony's second part, Mahler had hoped to make this his largest statement about the union between creativity and love. But what emerges is an overstated, abstract yet rather corny theology, with an occasional passage of quiet beauty to temper the relentlessly worked-up ecstasy.
Thank you.
Tennstedt succeeds in injecting the Mahler Eighth, Mahler's most impersonal symphony, with his own personal urgency and warmth. It begins ferociously but not melodramatically, and never lets up, which I think is what gives those extended passages of uneasy repose such moving and haunting conviction. Typically, the slew of vocal soloists doesn't rise to the exalted level of the Philharmonic's choir, the Tiffin School Boys Choir, or the Marvelous Orchestra. But French alto Nadine Denise, Finnish baritone Jorma Heinonen, and German bass Hans Sotin make some eloquent contributions. We can only hope that Tennstedt will get well enough at least to make more records. But if he can't, this one will be the most powerful reminder of the kind of musician he's been.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. The recording of Mahler's Symphony No. 8 with Klaus Tennstedt conducting is on the Angel label. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly. Together, they founded the magazine Raw to publish avant-garde comics and graphics from Europe and America. 8 issues have appeared since 1980. Pantheon has just published an anthology of highlights from the first 3 issues. Raw has billed itself as the graphics magazine that lost its faith in nihilism and the graphics magazine of abstract depressionism. Françoise is Raw's publisher, production designer, and co-editor. Art is co-editor and a cartoonist. He's known to a broader audience for his book Mouse, A Survivor's Tale. Told in comic strip form, Mouse is the story of how his Polish-Jewish parents survived the Holocaust and what it was like for him to grow up as the son of survivors. Mouse was first serialized in Raw magazine. Raw is difficult to describe, but I asked Art and Françoise to take a shot at it.
Well, Raw is kind of a literary magazine for the post-literate, basically. It's a graphics magazine, publishes large pictures and comics, but not comics like you grew up with, but comics like you might grow into. Publishes a whole bunch of people from different countries, all of whom have as their main common denominator the fact that they are seriously working in comics.
Well, the reason why we decided to publish a magazine is because this kind of comics was absolutely without a home. Nobody was interested in publishing work outside of just the standard fare of comics.
One of the things with the comic books that most people would be familiar with is that they're done by people who grew up reading comic books. So you get this kind of hemophiliac bleeder, fifth generation comic book artist that makes for a very finite, limited, self-enclosed system. And I suppose there's a place for it, but there's also should, I would hope, be room somewhere for things that have the same ambitions or the same scope of ambition that one would ordinarily look toward a novel or toward a serious film or to painting for.
Probably a lot of people say, if you're so interested in movies and literature and painting, how come you never graduated from comics and moved on to those other forms?
I graduated from other forms and moved on to comics. Started out doing some painting. But one of the things that was exciting about comics is it's only about 100 or so years old, and almost nothing's been done with it. It's just this fantastic medium that got, in a sense, stunted by the invention of cinema, which performed some similar functions more effectively. And the result was that comics were never allowed to fully grow up.
You both founded Raw as a vehicle for your own comics and for other people's comics that, that had no other home. Did you know a lot of other disenfranchised cartoonists whose work that you could incorporate into ROA?
Yes, and what we were looking for is a lot of disenfranchised publishers and editors that would pick up all this work and expose it. So after trying this a number of times, we decided to hell with it. We'll just do a magazine that will show all the work. So we did Raw 1, and we were very surprised when people said, like, when is the next issue coming out? We thought, like, well, somebody else will say, like, oh, this is great. I'm going to be publishing a magazine like this. But then we were stuck. We had to do a second issue and a third issue and so on.
And it's been making a very strong impact. And in some ways, I'm concerned about the impact it's been making.
What do you mean?
Well, see, the thing is, when we did Raw, we had a strategy, which was everybody thinks comics are these kind of dumb, disposable little things, and we'll just approach it with the same respect that one would approach to printing any other artwork if one could. Well, all this is great, except what I'm beginning to see is the same old crud, but now with very nice packaging. People have, in the publishing world, have taken their cue from Raw in the sense of applying high production values, but not necessarily in approaching the work itself as serious matter, as stuff that can have something to say, that can show you something that and give you a sense of a real experience. Instead, what I'm beginning to see is a lot of very standard comic book fare and even comic strip fare repackaged with flexi discs and gold embossed covers, but inside you get the same old stuff.
Francoise, I think most of the people who have done comics through the years have been men, and even like Action Comics and Marvel Comics, those kinds of comics are always a very boy-associated type of hobby. Do you feel like you're one of the few women in this new kind of comic graphic?
It actually is a problem sometimes to find myself in comic shops where I feel like I'm in Times Square in some kind of like porno. I mean, it's so imbued with teenage male fantasies. A lot of the way people read their book and the content of the book is so escapist. There are women that are now head of publishing companies, independent publishing companies. There are fewer women cartoonists, per se.
Art, you drew the first cover for Raw Magazine, and the cover showed a man sitting in an easy chair in his living room reading Raw Magazine, and behind him, out the window, you could see a body falling past the window, and it was obviously somebody who jumped out the window to kill themselves, jumped from a higher story in the apartment building. I think it's fair to say that suicide, alienation, despair have become kind of constant themes in the comics in Raw. Do you think that cartoonists are an especially depressed breed?
Oh, God, even that question is so depressing. Yes, I'm afraid. So, like, the first issue was called The Graphics Magazine of Postponed Suicides, which we took from a punchy one-liner by E.M. Curran. So I suppose that, like, a lot of the work is despairing. On the other hand, within what may seem to be depressing, there's a lot of stuff that also is very vital and sometimes very, very funny, even if behind the laugh is a scream.
You came of age at the same time as the underground comics really started to blossom. Underground comics really became associated with the counterculture and with smoking marijuana and dropping LSD. Do you think that that kind of countercultural association stunted its growth in a way?
Well, it's what made the growth possible, and then eventually it became a straitjacket that had a noose connected to it, yeah. See, what happened was at one point it was wonderful. Underground comics represent maybe the first time in the history of comics as a medium that there was such a thing as an avant-garde, people doing comics for the sake of doing comics. On the other hand, bit by bit it became typecast. So what people went to underground comics for were for titillating shock, for political commentary of a relatively jejune kind, for stuff that more and more seemed to be dominated by sexist material. The result was that it never found its way into a mainstream that allowed it to expand beyond that subculture. And as a result, like, yeah, it was set back for 10 years. When Raw first started appearing, things seemed like a complete vacuum. There was nothing else appearing. That's beginning to change now again.
In Raw Magazine, you can see the influence of the underground comics, and you can also see connections to, for instance, the Nancy comics, and you can even see connections to bubblegum comics. You have inserts in most of the editions of Raw. One of the inserts is a takeoff of baseball cards that you used to get with bubblegum. Did you used to enjoy those kinds of things when you were young?
Oh, yeah. I lived and breathed that stuff. And then I somehow wanted to keep it all with me as I grew up. I didn't want to let any of it go. I just wanted to sort of grow it up with me. One thing that I get scared of, now that I've been seeing all these articles appear about how comics are growing up, is that the whole medium could actually get fossilized in a kind of stuffiness. The closer we come to achieving our goal of making comics legit, the more I feel like doing something kamikaze-like and making something that's as outrageous as possible, because part of what's wonderful about comics is just how unlegitimate they are. I want to keep that as part of it.
You used to work for a bubblegum company.
Still do.
You still do?
Oh, sure. Garbage Pail Kids is the project that I'm very, very involved in on a weekly basis. If you've seen those, they're these little stickers with very ugly kids in them.
Right, right. Was it more like heaven or hell to actually be designing the kinds of bubblegum type cartoons and spin-offs that you used to love as a kid?
Oh, I think it's been a great honor to be able to do this kind of stuff. It's sort of like to try to warp kids' brains the way my brain was warped by Mad Comics. It seems like being able to take part in a wonderful anti-tradition.
How much of your home is given over to printing presses and other art-oriented machinery?
Until the birth of our baby, two-thirds of our place was the office, really, was where we worked. When Nadja was born, we couldn't continue like this, so we actually have a separate office now. And we're discovering this wonderful thing of having a house, having being able to like go home. I mean, we've been spending the past 10 years saying, I want to go home, but there was never a home to go to that wasn't also an office.
Of course, Françoise is painting a rosier picture than actually exists. We have this printing press that's stuck on the fourth floor of a walk-up loft that we can't get out. Now that we're trying to turn it into a living room, we tried putting flowers on it, but it still looks a little bit out of place.
Well, I thank you both for talking with us about your work.
Thanks, Terry.
Thanks a lot.
Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly have edited an anthology edition of Raw Magazine. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
How are you covering the stock market today?
Well, we'll have several stories. Stocks, of course, are back up today. They haven't gained back to anywhere to near where they were last Thursday, but traders are a lot happier today. That's what they've been telling us. We will have one story on how the market is handling the huge volume that it's been faced with over the last few days, and we'll find out if the market can sustain this kind of pressure. Also, a very hopeful story today for the millions of people around the world who suffer from river blindness. An American company has discovered accidentally a cure for the disease and now will be passing out drugs for free around the world.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on two words that in the 80s have risen to the rank of superlative.
You can get a good snapshot of the spirit of an age by looking at the superlative words that it favors. In the 50s, the highest praise you could give to something was to say that it was cool. In the 60s, the preferred terms were groovy and far out. In the 70s, well, I don't know that there were any characteristic superlatives in the 70s, but then I don't think of that decade as having had any particular cultural zeitgeist either. But the 80s certainly do have a flavor of their own, and they have the superlatives to prove it. Let's hear two cheers for world-class and serious. The phrase world-class comes from track and field, of course. Its meaning was originally pretty straightforward. A world-class runner or pole vaulter was somebody who was up to the level of international competition. The phrase started to get a wide currency around the beginning of the decade, maybe because it got a lot of exposure during the Los Angeles Olympics, or maybe because this was the period when every pro football team was raiding the ranks of Olympic sprinters to find some world's fastest human it could try out at wide receiver. But in the course of the past few years, world-class has gotten completely out of control. You read about world-class painters, world-class health spas, and world-class wines. A newspaper article talks about world-class crime, and the New York Times quotes someone as saying that AIDS has become a world-class tragedy. I even saw a headline in Vanity Fair describing someone as a world-class diplomat. I mean, what diplomat isn't world-class? The ambassador from Cleveland? World-class is an appropriate word to use when you're talking about things that can be measured against some absolute competitive scale. In high jumping, for example, you can just set the crossbar at 7'8" and see who gets over. And I can see why you might want to extend the term to other fields of competition, like chess or auto racing. But it's odd to hear people talk about world-class musicians and world-class newspapers. How do you identify the world-class pianists? Do you have them all play the minute waltz and clock them? This extravagant use of world-class is a sign of consumerism run amok. It makes people sound as if they had access to some cosmic consumer reports, which evaluated every human achievement in terms of a single universal standard of success. If something isn't world-class nowadays, it's most likely serious. The new BMWs are advertised as having serious aerodynamics. And the new Mitsubishi Gallant goes them one better. It's a serious luxury sedan. I hear this a lot from my friend Chip, who's at the cutting edge of yuppie culture. The other day, Chip announced that he had just gone out and bought himself a serious bandsaw. Now, if you didn't know better, this use of serious might puzzle you, because bandsaws aren't the kind of products you associate with frivolity in the first place. But of course, serious doesn't mean serious here. It really means something like appealing to people who are serious about their bandsaws. In this sense, you'll even hear things like, "That's a serious pizza," or, "Hey, we're talking about serious slapstick here." These uses are jocular, of course, but the implication is that you want to approach everything from bandsaws to pizzas with the deadpan intentness of a connoisseur. World-class and serious are the accolades of a generation who pride themselves first and foremost on being discriminating consumers, who can evaluate anything as if it were prospective purchase. Like the decade itself, the language of the 80s is all business.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University.
You're the top. You're the Colosseum. You're the top. You're the Louvre Museum. You're a melody from a symphony by Strauss. You're a Bendel bonnet, a Shakespeare sonnet. You're Mickey Mouse. You're the Nile. You're the Tower of Pisa. You're the smile.
Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with playwright Wendy Wasserstein. Her plays include Isn't It Romantic? And Uncommon Women and Others. She wrote the next edition of the PBS comedy series Trying Times. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new album by the American-born rock and soul singer Terrence Trent D'Arby. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Hope and Glory by director John Boorman. It's a look at wartime London, but through the eyes of an 8-year-old who saw the war as a round-the-clock party. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.